We're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick tock. It's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC.
NBC.
CBS.
CNN.
Fox News. Breaking news.
Faking news. The media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
Worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
General Myron, thank you, sir.
There was never a question.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. That's what the media seems to be saying whenever facing officials, rather than challenging them, they're thanking them for giving them access, thanking them for coming on their shows, thanking them for the job they're doing implicitly and often not looking at it the way a journalist should or could. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, here again this week with a program of interviews about the media, looking at issues that are not being examined in the media. Our first guest today, Jim Narekis. He's the magazine editor of Extra, the publication of fairness and accuracy in reporting. He's been the editor for a long time. It's a monthly journal of media criticism. He's the co-author of The Way Things Aren't, Rush Limbaugh's Reign of Error, and co-editor of The Fair Reader, a review of press and politics. He's also the co-manager of FAIR's website. FAIR is a leading progressive site for media criticism. It's been going for a long time, and Jim has been working there since 1990, and now is writing about what's happening in the news and in the world, particularly in the Ukraine. Hi, Jim. Hi. How are you doing? And thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Danny. I'm doing great.
So, you know, I want to just, before we get into the issues of the day, I'd like to let people know a little bit more about Fairness and Accuracy in Reporter. I mean, you worked as a journalist. You covered the Iran-Contra scandal. You were a managing editor of the Washington Report on the Hemisphere way back in the day. You graduated from Stanford University in political science. At the same time, you are someone who went from a career, a promising career in journalism, to a actually very influential career in media criticism. Tell us about that transition.
Well, I was a journalist for the magazine In These Times in Chicago, which is still a great alternative news source. If people have not seen it, they should check it out. The thing that struck me covering Iran-Contra was a big story. It was the story that everyone was writing about, and I was struck that from Chicago, this Cub reporter was able to write about aspects of it that weren't being talked about by the New York Times, Washington Post, ABC, CBS, and it occurred to me that this was not because I was some kind of genius reporter. I certainly didn't have the resources that other reporters had. I didn't have nearly the experience that other reporters had. And it really showed me how there are limits put on what the corporate media are able to talk about. You're writing about a scandal that implicates the whole foreign policy establishment, and you have to write very carefully about it so that you don't call into question the pillars of our society.
How is that? How do those controls work? I mean, you've been around doing this for a long time now. You've written hundreds of articles. You've read thousands of news reports. You've met many leading journalists. What occurred to you about the impact that our media has on American democracy and what the key problem here is?
Well, I think that that there is a sort of symbiotic relationship between the elite journalists and the powerful people in government. You define the most important news is what government is doing or going to do, and you are a success as a journalist if you are able to say that, you know, a day before government does something, that they're going to do it. And therefore, you need to be in the good graces of these government officials so that they'll pick you as the person to give the scoop to. You'll be the one who they allow to interview them, you know, on a Sunday morning show. It's access, you know, and it encourages a kind of stenography where, you know, because if you have someone on, have a senator on and point out the inconsistencies in their voting record, they're not going to come back. You know, you have them on and you make them look good, you make them look smart, and then they'll come back. And that's the kind of relationship that is built up over time between government and the press. They're really working together rather than the press working as a check on government.
Well, there seems to be a lot of rewards for those people who do the job that, as you're suggesting, they're really intended to do. I mean, we have a situation now where the host of Meet the Press in Washington, you know who I'm talking about, David,
yeah.
It's just been reported that he's just bought a $5.5 million home in Washington, D.C., after a few years of being on Meet the Press. So obviously, his income and his status has gone up. At the same time, there have been reports just today that Meet the Press as a show may be ending its run because its ratings are so low. So it's ironic that, you know, these programs seem to be aimed at a very small elite, not at the general public at large. And they seem to be a showcase of the people in power for other people in power.
Yeah, it's the point they make about David Gregory's salary. It's very, very important to remember when you're watching, you know, the top anchors on television, and you're getting your news from them. You're getting these are millionaires who are working for billionaires. And, you know, unless you think that where people get their paycheck has nothing to do with how they view the world, you're getting a very, very skewed opinion, you know, a very skewed perspective on world events. These are people who, you know, they never have to worry about health care for their children. They never have to worry about getting enough to eat, about, you know, their real estate problems have to do with, you know, their third home in the Hamptons. They do not have the same set of issues that 99% of the American people have, and so if they're going to talk about your problems, they're making an imaginative leap, you know, that you would have talking about the problems of someone living in third world poverty, because that's where they are compared to you. Unless you think that you could be a spokesperson for the third world poor based on your experience as a middle class American, that's the same difficulty that the people who are giving you the news from CNN or ABC or NBC have.
These people are recruited to do a job, and undoubtedly the people who recruit them have confidence in their, quote, political judgment. They know that when Glenn Greenwald comes on Meet the Press, David Gregory as a host will challenge him and question his bona fides and even suggest ask him why he shouldn't be in jail. I mean, that's not surprising necessarily. In fact, your organization, FAIR, has done a number of studies about who appears on cable TV and who doesn't. Can you tell us a little bit about that research that you've done?
Well, the most obvious thing when you look at who's appearing on cable news as sources is how white and male the general spectrum is. You're talking about sometimes upwards of 90% white, you know, 80% male, And then again, you know, obviously, I'm a white male myself. It's not that I don't think that white men have anything to say, but to think that our viewpoints are so, you know, like, overwhelmingly important that we should dominate the discussion, it's kind of absurd.
In other words, it's not very representative of our country, is it? I mean, it seems to be deliberately non-representative of our country in a way.
Yeah, and the people that the sort of walks of life that people come from who appear on cable news, first of all, they're largely journalists themselves, sort of interviewing each other, which is sort of solipsistic. And then most of the rest of the people are people in government or former government people. And that is the world of people who analyze the events of the day for the viewers.
Well, as you may know, Jim, you know, I worked in mainstream media. I worked at CNN. I worked at ABC News. I even did a stint at CNBC. Okay, so I was sort of on the inside. But there came a point in my career when I realized that the media that I had risen in, you know, into a, you know, high-paying job in a distinguished and prestigious organization, came to feel that media was doing more damage to the country than some of the most extreme groups, that it was actually a threat to democracy instead of an enhancement of democracy, you know, a forum for democracy.
Yeah, we go back to the First Amendment as sort of our touchstone, and we ask ourselves why is the freedom of the press guaranteed in the Constitution? And the answer is that it was thought that to have a democratic system that you needed to have open discussion of ideas of events, of policies. And without that kind of debate and discussion, you would not get the people would not be able to make judgments about where they wanted their government to be doing. And I think that by that measure, there's a complete falling down on the job on the part of corporate media. It's
interesting.
Very difficult to get a sense of what policies are working, what policies are not working from watching the news, because that is not what the news is about. You know, if you're watching coverage of an election campaign, you will not get discussions of here's what this person is proposing and here's what people who have some knowledge of the situation think would be the results of the policies that they proposed.
Well, it's interesting. I was just, you know, thinking when you were talking about the Constitution, is the people who are the loudest in championing the Constitution, who talk about the Constitution, you know, the Tea Party people and the people on the right who embrace the Constitution, wrap themselves in the flag, have very little to say about freedom of the press in real terms, of diversity of media, of different points of view being heard. They want their point of view to be heard, but they're not particularly interested in yours.
I think there is a difference in terms, you know, you do have critics of the system on the left and critics of the system on the right. And, you know, in some ways, you can see there are some shared complaints that the left and the right both have. But I do feel like the right is more often interested in getting viewpoints out of the debate that they think don't belong there. And the left is really more interested in having a perspective that isn't being heard, getting a place at the table.
Jim, recently you've been studying some of the big news stories of the day, particularly this Malaysian plane that was shot down over the Ukraine. This is a story that's been in every newspaper, and certainly in the American newspapers, there seems to be a finger pointing at Vladimir Putin, as in he did it. You know, he's responsible for it. He made it happen. And you took a different take, or you looked at it in a different way. Can you tell us a little bit about your current article, which is called "Are People Who Shoot Down Passenger Planes War Criminals or Hard to Fault?" What do you mean by that?
Well, we looked at the editorial that the New York Times put out after the shootdown of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. And the judgment of the Times in that editorial was very unequivocal. They said, whoever unleashed a lethal missile, not knowing how to distinguish between a military and a civilian plane, is not only irresponsible and stupid, but a war criminal. And that's a forthright stance to take, that if someone sees a plane and is not sure that it's a military plane and shoots it down anyway, that they are guilty of a crime.
Has the Times taken that same view in regards to other planes that have been shot down?
Well, that is the question that we ask ourselves. When we look back at the editorial that the Times ran after the United States Navy shot down Iran Air 655 in 1988. Now, your listeners may or may not remember this. It's not something that the corporate media tends to bring up. It's not a piece of history that they like to remember. If you do remember it, either you have a very good memory or you are paying attention to alternative media, because that's more than likely where you'd hear about it.
Well, 290 people were on board that flight and who died.
Right.
And the United States, to my knowledge, have never apologized for. They did pay some compensation ultimately, but they never apologized for targeting and shooting down that
plane. And it's a situation where, just like as we believe with Malaysia Airlines, that someone saw a passenger plane and mistook it for a military plane. That's what happened with Iran Air 655. But the Times judgment was not that this was irresponsible, stupid, or a war crime. The Times wrote after that shoot down, while horrifying, it was nonetheless an accident. On present evidence, it's hard to see what the Navy could have done to avoid it. And they invited readers to put yourselves in Captain Rogers' shoes. Captain Will Rogers, the person who commanded the shootdown of this plane. It is hard to fault his decision to attack the suspect plane. So it's really an entirely different judgment.
So this was not one of these separatists who are being accused of shooting down the plane with Putin's active backing, but this was a actual captain of a naval vessel. Moreover, one with a name that's very well known in American life, Will Rogers, which, you know, invokes the comedian. In a way, this statement is kind of comic.
And comparing the two situations, in both cases, I think the people probably felt that their lives were in danger. In one case, you had presumably amateurs who are, the Times was wondering how they even knew how to operate the equipment, because these are people who you don't expect to have sophisticated military training.
So that would argue, but that would argue against the notion that this was a premeditated act,
right,
orchestrated by none other than the president of Russia himself. This would suggest that somehow this was a mistake, an accident, a screw up, or people who didn't know what they were doing having access to very lethal equipment.
Yeah. Whereas in the case of the Iran air shootdown, it's a professional military with the most sophisticated technology that the Cold War produced to distinguish between a civilian airline and a military plane that would be a threat, and yet they failed to do so, and as a result 290 people died. And the Times found that completely understandable and really wanted the point of the editorial really was that you should have more empathy with the person who made this decision. And it's really hard to see what the difference between, for the Times, what the difference is between these two situations, other than in the one case, it's, you know, official enemies doing it, and in the other case, it's your own country. And so you hold your own country to a much lower standard, a much more generous standard, than you hold, you know, people who you politically oppose.
But aren't you finding a sort of kind of a line emerging, if you will, a mantra emerging in the American media, pointing the finger at Putin? I mean, this comes in a strange time historically. The day after Obama announces more sanctions on Putin, even though many in Europe didn't want more sanctions because they have, he's a supplier of their natural gas and all the rest of it. So there was a political set of issues going on here, the BRICS countries, with Putin prominently part of it. It announced plans to challenge the World Bank and to create their own bank. I mean, is there a possible setup here in your view? I mean, we don't know this because there has been no investigation.
Well, I think it's interesting that the assertion is made that that the equipment that could shoot down a plane flying at that altitude would have had to come from Russia. And I don't know whether that's true or not. It may be true. But the idea that is that if Russia supplied the equipment that was used, then Russia is really as guilty as the people who actually shot down the plane. Now, right now, there's a conflict going on in the Middle East, where the government of Israel is using weapons that were, in many cases, supplied to it by the United States in order to attack the territory of Gaza. And hundreds of people in Gaza have died, including, you know, many, many civilians. And yesterday I saw a figure of 161 children who had been killed in this attack. But there's no sense in U.S. news coverage that the United States is responsible for these deaths, even though the Israeli government is getting much of its military equipment from the United States. But there's no feeling like that the United States bears responsibility or has some some obligation to make sure that its weapons are not used in this way. In this situation, it's like, well, we gave them weapons, and it's up to them to decide what to do with them.
I just struck by
the difference in the way that the U.S. media views the United States' moral obligations versus the way it views other countries' moral obligations, particularly countries that are, you know, have an oppositional stance with the United States government.
Isn't there an assumption here that because these so-called rebels, separatists, call them what you will, but they are Ukrainians, speak Russian, because they speak Russian, therefore they are pro-Putin or pro-Russia, or that Russia somehow is orchestrating what they're doing? And yet the evidence for that has been extremely thin. It's been suggested, but not proven, it seems to me.
Yeah, there have been a couple of stories coming out of the New York Times that were really very credulous, where the United States government was putting out this line that the you know, there were forces from being sent in from Russia to orchestrate the separatist movement there. And on closer examination, the stories would sort of fall apart. It really made you wonder whether the New York Times had learned nothing at all from the days of Judith Miller, and when the U.S. government would give stories about all the dangerous weapons that Iraq had, and how we had to invade Iraq in order to make sure that they wouldn't be able to use these weapons. And then, of course, it all turned out that these stories were made up.
In this particular case, though, just if you flash back just a few weeks, it seems, or a few months, the discussion was about the role the United States was playing in supporting groups that were considered fascist, you know, far right-wing groups,
right,
under the guise of the National Endowment for Democracy, that various so-called NGOs were being funded and encouraged by the United States to overthrow the government of the Ukraine. Now, when the situation is a little bit different, you have people saying, well, it's the Russians who are, you know, behind all of this. Well, you know, but whether or not the Americans were ever behind anything has sort of quickly been dropped from the discussion. And, you know, in addition to that, and this is also, I think, extremely troubling, you have a Ukrainian government that just fell apart. The prime minister resigned. There's going to have to be new elections once again. It seems like a very unstable environment there. And to blame this on the rebels and separatists, I think, is really kind of stretching things. On top of that, of course, you have the United States covertly, according to a number of accounts, encouraging the Ukrainian military to take a hard line, to bomb civilians in the eastern cities there, and create to try to kind of wipe them out militarily. So this is not a conflict that's just a local conflict. It seems to be have a lot of international participation, including from our own government.
There's a great line in the Bible about how you should not be concerned about the mote in your neighbor's eye. You should worry about the beam that's in your own eye. And I think that's very sound moral advice, that you should worry about the morality of your own government's actions, and that should be of greater concern to you than the morality of other countries' actions.
Well,
but I find that the U.S. media takes exactly the opposite position, that the assumption is that whatever the U.S. government does is almost by definition moral, and really the main focus is to look for things that governments that have been declared to be enemies have done, and condemn those, and that is that seems to be the main role of the international correspondent.
Well, Jim Narekis, thank you so much for agreeing to be with us at the last minute here on Media Channel Radio. We really appreciate it. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. I never expected to have the Bible quoted to me by a member of FAIR and your team, but I appreciated that there is a concern about morality there that is coming through clearly in your work. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting is available online, fair.org. Please check out what they have to say. Stay with us here on this program for more about the media and the world we're living in. Not in good shape, is it?
Wish you were soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Morning, Sandy Station carries no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation.
Come all you good workers. Well, that song is, unfortunately, we didn't get to hear it too much, but it's really about which side are you on, and it's a song that really raises a profound question that listeners, viewers, and media consumers need to address. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Media Channel Radio. Moving now to Canada, of all places, to talk about perspectives on what's happening in our world from the founder of Global Research, and a website, globalresearch.ca, that offers a wide range of viewpoints, including, I would disclose, my own, to talk about what's happening in our world. And its director, Michel Chudzodowski, is a Canadian economist, a professor of economics at the University of Ottawa. He's been a visiting professor internationally. He's been an advisor to governments of developing countries. He's the author of several books, The Son of a Russian Emigre, a career UN diplomat as well. So, you know, he's a person who's extremely tuned in to what's happening in the world, but he's not necessarily a part of or shaped by American culture, and that may give him some advantages in trying to understand the world that we're living in. Welcome, Michelle, and well, so happy to talk to you.
I'm delighted to be on the program, and we're also delighted to have you as a regular contributor. We've been reading you for several years now.
Well, I thought it would be time to talk to each other directly because, you know, I have to say that your website actually gets millions of views all over the world. It's very well packaged. It's well read. And it's also very controversial because there are very few issues that you don't take on with a critical eye.
Well, thank you very much. We have a strong readership and support from that readership. That's very encouraging. In the last week, the readership of the Global Research has gone up to 270,000 unique readers. It's tied into the crisis which the world is living, focusing on the MH17 catastrophe, but also on the situation in Gaza. I think it's in some respects it's also the fact that people are giving up on the mainstream media. They don't want to read it anymore. They don't want to listen. So they come to us. We're a very, very small operation. Everybody, all the authors are volunteers, the editors are volunteers. We've got a small staff, and we work round the clock. The last few days have been very busy, but rewarding in many regards because the truth is getting out.
Well, thank
dramatic
you.
Because people are dying in Gaza and Ukraine. I should mention that one dimension which has not been emphasized is that there is a war in eastern Ukraine. It's not simply an exchange of gunfire. It is a theater war. 1,600 soldiers were reported killed on the Kiev regime side. There 500 or 600 civilians killed, according to Kiev data. I have the data from both sides, but the picture which we must understand is that this is a war theater. It's comparable to a major war theater, and it's not simply conflict. And the mainstream media hasn't covered it. Okay,
it's actually described as a battle between so-called separatists whose politics and whose background is rarely explored, and a government which seems to have legitimacy, although it's just been reported that the prime minister resigned and that the government has collapsed, the government of the Ukraine, and that they want to have new elections. So this is a chaotic environment, needless to say, and a very violent one. And yet the full contours of it somehow is not getting across to us. What's reported to us are incidents, and this plane, of course, the crash was probably one of the most dramatic. But it's part of, a larger war there, and you've been trying to analyze this as well. And I want to get your analysis of it in terms of what your readers are being exposed to. But before we do that, I'd really like our listeners to get to know you a little bit more. What's your background? How did you get into, as a professor of economics, into analyzing news and information? What led you in that direction? And what do you think you've learned from doing so?
Well, I've had a university career. I should mention, you mentioned this at the beginning of the program, that I'm detached from the United States. Well, I have a PhD from the University of North Carolina, which really entitles me to some American affinity, and I have loads of friends in the United States. And
So you're telling me you're a good old boy.
That's right. But I mean, I'm. My father is born in Russia, but I was born in Wales, and I have. I also have Irish citizenship because I'm half Irish, half Russian. My father comes from the region which is now affected by the crisis. My family comes from Rostov-on-the-Don, which is more or less, 80 kilometers from Donetsk. And so that region is very, it has a certain culture. It's the crossroads of major wars. It's an important area from the point of view of geopolitics, but also culture. You can go back in history to the Napoleonic Wars, to the First and Second World War. It's the crossroads of major rivers, the Volga, the Don, the Black Sea, the Sea of Azov. It's through that area, incidentally, that's very important, that you have a maritime route linking the Mediterranean to the Caspian Sea. It goes through the Dardanelles, up through the Black Sea, then to the Sea of Azov, up the Don in the area which is now at war, and then it goes down the Volga to the Caspian Sea. People don't realize how strategic that region is. So that was... I mean, when this happened, it's something which I feel because I've been to the Crimea, I've been to Rostov on the Don, I speak a little bit of Russian, but to get back to the beginnings of global research, well, essentially, global research started just a few days before 9/11. And we were publishing various, various perspectives. Our editorial policy has always been ultimately to allow for different perspectives as long as it's truthful and honest. People who present a certain point of view, sometimes we say, oh no, that we can't publish this because it's biased and we don't publish it. But we have now something of the order of 6,000 authors over a period of years. So, of course, not all of those authors are regular authors, but we got a vast array of outstanding authors. We have a partnership relationship with other websites. We have exclusives, but we don't believe in the notion of exclusives. The whole idea is that we provide a place where people who have blog sites or can cross post. We also believe we don't believe in pundits. We don't believe in people who are necessarily well known. We have many well known scholars who contribute, like Peter Dale Scott or John McMurtry, James Petras, to contribute on a regular basis. But then we also have students. We have people who are in the workplace who do it in their spare time, and we will evaluate the quality of an article based on the submission. It's a very different dynamics to, and we don't believe in competing with other websites in alternative media. Quite the opposite. We like to work with them.
What I find interesting is just the idea that research is something that you champion, that research and analysis is something that you think is a good thing, okay? As opposed to people who have strong opinions but have very little to back them up with, that is to say context and background or any really deeper understanding of what's going on in the world. It seems as if you've created a focus on globalization as some of the dynamic factors that have brought our world together or is tearing it apart. And you're promoting research in that through all these different articles, and it's a very impressive range of authors and a lot of diversity of viewpoint. This is why I think some of the criticism that's come your way, you know, you're anti-Semitic, you're anti-American, you're this or you're that. Yeah. Misses the fact that you actually have covered issues from lots of different points of view. You seem to believe in that.
Well, we believe in that, and we have contributors who are libertarians, and we have contributors who are leftists. We're not strong in bipartisan politics, because the problem that many websites have in the United States, and this is not a criticism, is that they have some affiliation to, let's say, the Democrats, okay? And there are certain things they don't like to tackle. And that's understandable. But up here in Canada, we can say whatever we want about U.S. politics. and that's why we have a vast range of U.S. writers who are from, some of them are Republicans, some are Democrats, some are Green, most of them, I would say, are independent. But the thing is, I think that if we want to, we have to sort of divorce ourselves from partisan politics to present that kind of thing.
Let me just jump in here with one.
We try to back up everything with factual analysis. Now, not everybody does that. Some people are involved in very short articles, and other people are doing longer pieces. Some of them are academics who present research texts and so on. I've been working at the university right from the beginning. I've also done extensive work overseas. First in Latin America, in the 70s. I've lived through a couple of military coups. I've done research in Latin America. I've lived there. Then I've worked in Asia, in China. In particular, China and Thailand, and I've done a fair amount of work in Africa as well. But all this has provided me with an understanding of analysis and research on realities. And then I think in the 90s and the 21st century, I started to examine the interaction between economic phenomena and political phenomena, including geopolitics and intelligence, and the acts of deceit and intelligence, underlying intelligence. Provide a very different perspective on economic phenomena, okay? Because then you say, do the laws of the market prevail as we're supposed to teach in economics classes, or are they manipulated? And are they manipulated? Does advanced foreknowledge of an event, let's say MH17, have an economic impact? How are prices set? How are decisions made? And I started to develop, I think, as of the late 90s, an understanding also of the relationship between war and the global economy. And I was very active in the anti-globalization movement, but the moment I started looking at war, particularly with regard to Yugoslavia, people didn't particularly like that, because you have an anti-globalization perspective, but you don't necessarily analyze broader issues like regime change and let's say covert operations and this kind of thing, that doesn't enter into the discourse, or at least it didn't enter into the discourse of progressive organizations in the 1990s.
So were you proud, for example, to be called by Terry O'Neill in the Western Standard one of Canada's nuttiest professors?
Yeah.
Or just amused. Or just amused.
Well, that was written in a magazine in the West. But ironically, I also got the Ottawa Citizen attempted to smear me. But it just so happens that a few years back, they did a special op and they said how great I was. And so that you have all sorts of contradictions. I must say that on the whole, I lived through those. It's part of sometimes we crack out laughing. Sometimes we find this a little bit disturbing when people, particularly, I usually respond to people who make a strong statement where I feel that they misunderstand. And I said, well, please, before you make up your mind, have a look at these documents. I have a lot, there are people now who have very strong feelings about, what's going on in Gaza. And we get statements to the effect that, particularly from Jewish people, but, not exclusively, but saying, no, Israel is under attack, et cetera. But the levels of media distortion have reached such, they've reached a pinnacle to the extent that people's minds are completely confused. And I don't think we should go after the readers of the New York Times. We have to go after the New York Times. I mean, this morning, New York Times, they said what they said was, essentially, Hamas is responsible for the deaths of civilians. That's what they're saying. Hamas is responsible. Hamas likes people to die because then they can use it for public relations. And address the international community, so to speak.
Well, Michelle,
and then you had a piece in the.
Let me cut you off here for a second because you've established your credentials and affinity for the region in Russia that's really close to this area, the zone of conflict in the eastern Ukraine. How do you approach this issue? What kinds of questions should we be asking ourselves about it? I know you've carried a lot of articles. There's a lot of back and forth on this issue. But where do you come down on it? What do you think we need to know that we are not, the information that we're not getting? What questions should be concerned with?
I think the central issue there has to do with the fact that President Yanukovych was unseated. He's a democratically elected president, whether we like him or not. And he was unseated by a movement, Euromaidan, which was supported covertly by the United States of America. But within that movement, the most predominant forces were neo-Nazis. And in fact, we could say they were Nazis because they're Nazis because they have maintained a tradition right from World War II. And those two parties, Right Sect and Svoboda, were supported also by the United States and its allies. And subsequently what happened, and that's very important for the American public, is that that identity of the Kiev government, its neo-Nazi identity, has been obfuscated. People will say, oh, well, yes, there are neo-Nazi elements there, but they're not really. No, they won't say that. They're not neo-Nazis. They'll say they're ultra-conservatives, they're radicals, they're right-wing. And I did a research on a Google search to see that, in fact, the mainstream media does not use the term neo-Nazi to describe these parties, although they themselves describe themselves They describe themselves as neo-Nazis. But what is more, the government also uses neo-Nazi symbols, because the National Guard, which is like the National Guard in the United States of America, it's coordinated by the Ministry of the Interior. So it's a state organization. It's linked to the armed forces. Well, they have the SS symbol and the swastika on their uniforms.
So where does the plane fit into this? Because we're running out of time. I'm trying to get to your analysis of this current story, where all fingers of blame in our country is really pointing at Putin. He did it. It's his fault. He's responsible.
Well, now it would appear that that information has been refuted. The thing is that immediately when this occurred, without any kind of background or investigation, Washington and its allies blamed Moscow. Okay, it was immediate. It was instantaneous and without any evidence. And what they've also done is that they've heightened the sanctions directed against the Russian Federation. And it now appears, because a lot of information has come forth, that the plane entered into Ukrainian airspace and was ordered to deviate from its path, which goes over the Sea of Azov. Okay, and I know that region. The Sea of Azov is further south, and then they were pushed northwards towards the war zone. All other flights, which were scheduled out of Amsterdam or any European capital, they're 150 a day. They fly over the Sea of Azov. They don't fly over the war zone. So there was an action on the part of the air control tower in Kiev, Borisopol Airport, to deviate that flight towards the war zone. And then there was evidence of a fighter jet, a Ukrainian SU fighter jet, in proximity of the aircraft in a corridor which was reserved for commercial aircraft. It's illegal for a fighter jet to enter that corridor. That was revealed by the Russian Ministry of Defense. We can always say, well, is it authentic or not? But U.S. intelligence has now confirmed that Russia is not to blame. Although whether the media is going to pick that up or not, that's another matter. But essentially, this crash is a geopolitical crash. It's people lost their lives in there as a result of a criminal political undertaking, and it has to be investigated. The evidence suggests that Russia was not behind it, and the evidence that we've collected suggests that the Ukrainian regime, which is supported by the West and which is integrated by neo-Nazi elements, could have played a role in this catastrophe.
Whether they did or not, at least it's an important question, and it's an important question that deserves investigation. Every air crash, to my knowledge, has investigators to try to find out what happened and why. I covered an air crash back in Vietnam, back in the last days of the war. It turned out to be a defective door on the plane that led to a crash killing hundreds of children and causing mental damage to many others who were so being rescued from Vietnam at the time. It wasn't until there was an investigation that we actually could find out what happened. And there's an investigation that Putin himself and Angela Merkel have called for here. So whether or not that'll happen or not, I don't know. But it's been very politicized. And I think if you want to find other perspectives other than the ones you read in the New York Times, you should check out the globalresearch.ca. Thank you so much, Michelle Shododowsky, for being with us on Media Channel Radio, and also for the work that you do. I appreciate it very much.
We appreciate having you as an author, and I'm delighted to be on the program, and look forward to future debates and discussions.
Okay, great.
And I think your article just went up today on best wishes to everybody.
Okay, thank you so much. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. If you want to write to me, you can write to dissector@mediachannel.org. This program will be available in the archives and also on mediachannel.org in a day or two, as all of our interviews are posted there. All the podcasts are available for you to listen to and to comment on if you choose to. Thank you again for being here, for listening, and I hope to see you again, or I hope to you'll hear from me again next week on PRN FM. Thank you.
To chase and to walk home.